Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about what happens if you use antidepressants and painkillers. Not a good combination. I'll explain why. Also, you've heard of resveratrol from grapes and from wine, and quercetin from apples and onions. Put them together, a new option for cancer therapy, according to Oregon State University. We'll explore that. Also, can ginger help reduce muscle damage after an exercise? Some really good research from the University of North Carolina. Additionally, the health benefits of sprouted grains. Someone asked me, what do you mean by a sprouted grain? Well, I'll tell you what a sprouted grain is and why, if you're gluten intolerant, not a problem. It does a lot of good for you. And also, we'll talk about yeast and from an interesting study of how this impacts our health. Also, green tea and cancer, more on that. So we have a lot on health and healing. And then we're going to hear from a young lady. She's only 23 years of age, and she's speaking out for the first time after 2 years after receiving her Gardasil vaccine. I wanted you to hear what Brittany has to say in her own words. And if you're living in California, many of you, hundreds of thousands of you, came out in support of allowing parents a right to choose to vaccinate or not. The state overruled you. The governor overruled you. KPFA, Pacifica, and its management overruled you. Anti-women, because that's the bottom line. There's a consequence to their actions. I believe Brittany's story is worth hearing to show you what happens, because remember, California is only the first. Every single state will be going through mandatory vaccine now that they won in California, now that Big Pharma gave enough legislators enough money, bought the vote. We'll talk about that. Also, I want to give you a different perspective on Greece today from Professor Ellen Brown. The Greek debt is not real. No, it's not. The media doesn't talk about that. You hear no one saying, okay, we've got this $388 billion. Now you're saying you're going to give them another $60 to $80 billion. Well, that would make them having over $400 billion, and with compounding interest that they can't pay, $500 billion, $500 billion, what's the point of that? Isn't there another way? The good news is, yes, there is another way. I'll share with you today how the people of Greece, who are listening now, we have people all over the world listening, and a lot of activists and educated people, what you can do in your next set of demonstrations. Also today, we'll show you how we really impact regime change. How do we get our way around the world? Well, how the CIA kills countries. John Perkins, he was the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I interviewed him. He describes how the United States of America, through corporations and the CIA, wages economic wars against the third world countries in order to control their resources. And where economics fail, well, the CIA will come in to assist and overthrow any non-compliant government. And when that fails, they just kill people. Yeah, it's that simple. It's not personal. If you don't agree to go along with their corruption, you die. We'll talk about that. He will talk about that. Then the guest in the second part of our program, who can give us a really different explanation than anyone in the American media. And shame on the reporters for the New York Times. These are bright people. They're capable and have done some very good reporting. Why have they chosen to be stupid about everything involving the Ukraine, including Pacifica programming? We'll set the record straight. Robert Perry, in my opinion, the best progressive investigative journalist anywhere. Remember, he was the one who uncovered Iran-Contra and all of North's involvement, and he won the George Polk Award. He writes for Consortium News. We're going to talk about the mess the U.S. made in the Ukraine, relations with Russia, and why are they trying to start a World War III or a new Cold War? Why? Why isn't this being discussed? We'll discuss it. And we discuss the issues that I believe are important. And a lot of you, by the way, are able to listen right now, not because you're at home or at office listening over radio or maybe your computer, because you're driving someplace, you're walking someplace, you're jogging or biking, and you've got some portable listening device plugged into your ear. And I want everyone to have this number because this is the way you can always listen no matter where you're at. This, listen by the telephone, call this number, 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. Let's begin. First up, this article has half of it right and half of it, well, I won't say wrong because I think it's extremely well-intended, but they're misinformed. First, the good part. This is from the British Medical Journal. Quote, taking a combination of antidepressants and common painkillers is associated with an increased risk of bleeding soon after starting treatment, and researchers say their results have been may have been affected by other unmeasured or unknown factors. But here's the bottom line. Millions, tens of millions of people suffer from depression. And we know that depression can impact the body in very negative ways. And also, when you're depressed, you're more likely to have stress hormones like cortisol that are very deadly when they're not turned off, when they're in the on position all the time because you have anxiety, loneliness, rage, anger issues. They're always pumping these hormones that are only meant for flight or fight for about a minute, and you've been going at it for years. So one day, you take an antidepressant. All right, I'm against all antidepressants. But at the same time, you're also taking a painkiller because more often than not, depressed people are in pain. And so what kind of painkiller do most people take? And this is where they get it wrong. They could take cat's claw or cayenne, capsicum, the active ingredient in the red pepper that makes it hot, is very healing. They could also take some essential oil aromatherapies, Bach flower remedies, homeopathics. They could help turn off the pain and reduce inflammation. They could take what are called cytokine quenchers. These are ones that will tamp down pain and cause no side effects because they're natural. Instead, people take non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. These are anti-inflammatories, and they're bad to the bone. And what happens is, if you take them with an antidepressant drug, you increase your risk of bleeding into your skull, quote, intracranial hemorrhaging. So a team of researchers compared the risk of bleeding among patients treated with the antidepressants with and without non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And they did it involving 4 million people over 4 years. So this is a huge study. And what they found was, it's bad. So if you know someone who's in pain and taking the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which is what 99% of people take, and if you're with depression and you're taking antidepressants, you're at a very high likelihood of causing brain hemorrhaging or microstrokes. So we can deal with depression without drugs, and we can deal with pain without the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Now, another good study from Oregon State University found that by using resveratrol and quercetin, two very popular natural remedies, these two polyphenols have been studied in thousands of studies, thousands, and they're very beneficial. That's why I always recommend you have grape juice, grapes, grape concentrate, grape skin extract, grape seed extract, grape powders, any combination. As long as you're getting the grape, you're getting benefit. Quote, resveratrol, a powerful antioxidant found in red wine and other foods, has already received much attention as a possible explanation for the French paradox, a low incidence of cardiovascular disease despite a diet high in the fats. The new research suggests it may soon have value far beyond that. Laboratory researchers at Oregon State University have developed a system to increase the bioavailability of these compounds in the body by using copolymers that make them water-soluble and allow their injection into the bloodstream, creating levels that are far higher than could ever be obtained by diet or oral intake. The resveratrol and quercetin then appear to reduce the cardiac toxicity of a very widely used cancer drug, adriamycin. Although highly effective in the treatment of lymphomas, breast and ovarian and other cancers, adriamycin can only be used for limited time in humans because of its cardiotoxicity. The co-administration of these polyphenols might allow much more extensive use of the drug, while at the same time improving its efficacy and demonstrating the polyphenols' own anti-cancer properties. This was published in the Journal of Controlled Release and by scientists from the College of Pharmacy at Oregon State University. My thoughts on this. Once again, they got half of it right. There are thousands of studies on quercetin. What does quercetin do? Well, if you have blood vessels that are bursting easily, if you have damage to your epithelium, if you have allergic reactions, let's say you have something that's causing mucus in the body, all that. If you want to naturally thin your blood so you don't clot, have a stroke, it comes from apples. You get a lot in the skin. That's why I suggest taking one day a week and skinning five apples, putting the skin of five apples in a blender, adding in some coconut oil, flaxseed oil, some vitamin C, some walnuts and berries, your favorite liquid, blending that and drinking that down as a smoothie. You could also put some protein, vegetable protein powder. The amount of polyphenols and quercetin that you'd be getting is really high, and that would help your heart, your blood sugar. It's just an overall great tonic. Now, with resveratrol, I would do the same thing, but I would use resveratrol powder. Now, here's where I would share a different point of view. They're looking at adriamycin. They want to see you use it longer and have more people use it. Why don't you ask, who owns the patent on adriamycin? I know who owns the patent on cytoplasma, adriamycin, 5-fluorouracil. Which one of those is owned by the American Cancer Society? And then you start to see, who promotes these chemotherapy agents? You also look at the good quality independent peer review literature on these chemotherapy agents, and you won't find any studies of long-term survival of end-stage cancers using their chemotherapy. None. Zero. And yet, that's what you get when you have cancer, clear up to death, or when they say, well, you know, there's nothing more can be done, but we have an experimental drug. Let them show you one patient in the history of medicine that has used one of their experimental drugs at the end of life. Maybe a person has 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, a year to live, and show me one that's lived. Instead of allowing the person to go home and set their life right until they pass, when you start taking these drugs, you don't have a life. You have pain, you have ulcerations, you have memory loss, you have the capacity for heart attacks, liver breaking down, kidneys breaking down, lungs breaking down. The side effects of chemotherapy are devastating. In any responsible and reasonable society, we would never be using it. But we don't have a responsible and reasonable medical community. As a society, they have people that dictate what the protocols are, and they follow them. not a good idea. So bringing in two natural treatments that have both been shown to help with cancer as part of overall therapies, but eliminate the chemotherapy part and start looking at the Burton method, the Brzezinski method, the Virginia Livingston Wheeling method, the Issels method as your base therapy, and then using living foods, including these nutrients and a lot of others, that makes sense. Trouble is not being done. Can ginger help reduce muscle damage? This is the University of North Carolina, published in the peer-reviewed journal Phytotherapy Research. Quote, it appears that this ginger supplementation protocol delayed muscle damage. All right, well, that's good. Why? Because of what is called rhizome. That's the plant. I grow ginger, by the way. It grows into, if you let it grow, it's very hardy. It will grow 20 feet high. Beautiful white flowers come out at night. And then it's the root. You pull up the plant and you'll get, depending upon the size of the plant, you can get a root that's 4 or 5 inches, or I've seen roots as long as almost a foot. In which case, then you peel it down, grate it, chop it, dice it, or juice it. But the nutrients that are in there can help turn off pain. It's a strong anti-inflammatory. And that's why I recommend ginger as maybe 1 ounce a day with some lemon juice and warm water to start the day. Why? Because they're what are called gingerols. Gingerol is G-I-N-G-E-R-O-L-S. You also have what are called shogols, S-H-O-G-A-O-L-S, and zingerones, Z-I-N-G-E-R-O-N-E-S, and other ketone derivatives. These all possess one thing, anti-inflammatory activity. They also are antioxidants. So if you want to turn off arthritis pain, fibromyalgia pain, lower back pain, muscle tightness pain, cramps in your leg pain, 2 ounces of ginger juice with lemon juice from 2 lemons diluted in about 12 ounces of a warm tea or cold tea, that will do it. And finally, a new study came out. This is from Tel Aviv University, published in the peer-reviewed journal Journal of Bone and Mineral Research, and it was also done at Hebrew University, and it showed that cannabis was able to treat fractures very successfully. And in a non-psychotropic compound, meaning they isolated the cannabinoids, which are frequently used to help people with Parkinson's and cancer, multiple sclerosis, but it helped substantially improve bone remineralization. Quote, the clinical potential of cannabinoid-related compounds is simply undeniable at this point. While there is still a lot of work to be done to develop appropriate therapies, it is clear that it is possible to detach a clinical therapy objective from the psychoactive activity of cannabis. And the principal agent in our study is a primarily anti-inflammatory and has no psychoactivity, end quote. So that's a good study, shows that it could help people prevent hip fractures, it could help bones that are thinning and breaking. Terrific. And finally, from the Journal of the American Medical Association's Oncology, 300 minutes a week, that's not much, just divide 7 into 300, it's not a lot each day, for reducing total fat in postmenopausal women. We have a lot of postmenopausal women. We have probably I'm going to say in the neighborhood of 40 million. So it could help you lose your body fat. I've seen body fat indexes in the 40s. That's really high. And the higher it is, you increase your rate of heart disease substantially, and stroke substantially, and diabetes substantially. So the more you're able to get that body fat down, what do I believe an ideal level should women for women should be? I believe that if you're between 12 and 14%, you're in the ideal range. You're going to live a longer life. I did mention I would talk about sprouted grains, and even though we got a packed show, I'll take a moment to do it. I'm sprouting right now. Well, I'm not personally sprouting, but I have a person for an upcoming retreat starting to sprout grains. Over 100 trays will be sprouted. In fact, we started today. And as these are rinsed and sprouted, and you can do broadcast sprouting, meaning you just broadcast them onto some quality dirt and then slightly cover them just enough to keep them from being blown away. And then you rinse it 3 times a day with trays that have holes in the bottom that allow the water to come out so you don't create mold. Then these grains, the seeds, end up creating grasses. And so what most people call a grain is actually just a seed of grasses, like wheat grass, oat grass. All these are grasses. So sprouting these simply means that you're germinating them into tiny little plants, what we call seedlings. Now, if you then use them at the level where they're a seedling, small, there's no gluten in them. They're gluten-free, but they're very rich in the B vitamins and vitamin C, folate, and essential amino acids, the building blocks of protein, rich in antioxidants. All of those are in the sprout. Now, what do sprouts do, germinated sprouts? They lower your blood pressure. Like buckwheat is terrific at lowering high blood pressure. They control your blood sugar, which means they have a glycemic, glycemic, a blood sugar. That's very good if you're pre-diabetic, overweight, or diabetic. They also lower your bad cholesterol. Your LDL is your bad cholesterol. It lowers it. They're great for liver functioning. It turns off inflammation in there, and also they're rich in a nutrient I mentioned earlier, quercetin. And you're going to have a healthier liver, and especially if you have cirrhosis of the liver or fatty liver disease or hepatitis scarring, then you'll want to have sprouts in your diet. So those are the things that sprouts can do, and that's why a sprouted grain, they're great for you, very healthy, very healing, and we should be consuming on a regular basis. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come back. Please stay with us.
Hello, stranger. It seems so good to see you back again. How long has it been?
It seems like a mighty long time. Chupa, chupa, my baby. Ooh.
It seems like a mighty long time. Oh.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. Next Tuesday, we'll be opening up our new corporate headquarters and our new state-of-the-art radio studios. And I look forward to inviting the people to come in and take a look. And I'm going to be donating some additional equipment. We found out that we got a brand new state-of-the-art board. Our old board was only a year old, but we'll give it to one of our sister stations as a gift. Also, I'm going to be hiring part-time, but good wage, a custodian, someone who can come in and keep place clean 3 days a week. If you're interested in that job, give a call at 646-926-5422. And also, we have so many people who want to get nutritional counseling. And we can't help everyone. There's just hundreds. So if you are a qualified nutritionist, if you have a background, preferably a master's degree in clinical nutrition, you have deep experience, then we're hiring full-time. We pay really good money, but you then counsel free. So anyone who comes to see you at our office, they come for free. So if you want to be considered and interviewed by me next week, call that same number, 646-926-5422. Now, for people who want to be counseled next week, three of our four nutritionists are full. Celestina has room on Tuesday and Wednesday only for free counseling, health counseling. She's terrific, by the way. You can call 212-874-4000, 212-874-4000, and make an appointment. Again, it doesn't cost you anything, and it helps you. And that's the point of the exercise. Now, I'm looking forward to being out there a week from this Sunday. I believe we're almost filled, and they took the largest of their theaters, the Huntington Arts Cinema, for the premiere of my newest film, Saving the Planet. So it's in Huntington, Long Island, at the Cinema Arts Center. You can call the number to make a reservation. I'll be there at noon, 631-423-7610. 631-423-7610. Now let's hear from Brittany. Brittany gives an emotionally charged overview of what her life has been like for the past 2 years. She struggles daily with the fact her life has been changed forever. A doctor frightened her into taking the Gardasil vaccine by telling her she could get a human papillomavirus through a possible lab accident at college where her blood could mingle with someone else who had the virus. She was never told that the human papillomavirus are sexually transmitted diseases and have no other information. She allowed herself to be given a vaccine she never needed. Now she wants to tell you the results. And why am I playing this? Because there is still an opportunity to go into court to challenge the absurdity of what they're doing in California by saying a parent has no right, no exemptions at all, because they're going to use that in every state in America. It's going to come to New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, to a state near you. And here are the hidden faces, the silent voices you won't see if you're a legislator and you don't care about if you're a vaccine maker or a state or federal bureaucrat. Listen in.
Hi, my name is Brittany Feist, and in 2007, I was scared into taking the Gardasil shot. In June, I had my first shot right after my 21st birthday, and in August 24th, 2007, I had my second shot. After the second shot, I became very, very ill. With the first one, I was starting to get some signs, but we didn't put it together with what was happening with me. And when I took the second one, it was official. I had had an adverse reaction. I lost the ability to walk. I started falling down. I needed help. I had head pressure that would press from my skull down to my jaw and into my neck and my back, and I would end up talking with like a ventriloquist because I could not move my jaw. My back and my neck would swell very large, and it felt like a baggie of water was on my neck and my back, on the back of my neck. I had seizures for a year and a half. I also have had problems with a rash. I still have the rash. I don't have the seizures anymore, but I do still struggle. I have trouble with my vision. Right now I'd be wearing sunglasses if I could, but I can't because you need to see my face and all my facial expressions. This is very hard to talk about. It's pretty much taken 2 years of my life away. I'm going to be 23 next week. And I feel like all my hopes and dreams have been ripped from me. I can't go to school. I can't be normal. I can't go out with friends. I can't have a good time. I can't handle noise. I can't handle conversations. This vaccine has to be taken off the market. It's stealing too many lives. And people need to see the truth, and it needs to not be covered up by any pharmaceutical company. It's very painful to deal with when you can't feel your legs. And the doctors say I'm going to get better, and they're working with me, and I'm taking supplements and vitamins and all these different things, but they say it's going to take a very long time to recover. This is not what I wanted at the age of 23 for a life. I did not want to be stuck at home, feeling trapped around four walls in different rooms. We're stuck on one level of my house. I wanted to be out driving. I wanted to be in school. I wanted to have a degree and a life. So if this helps, which I hope it does, people need to stop taking things from commercials and saying, oh, that sounds great, and start doing.
This is a real person. 145 dead children, all healthy before they took the vaccine. Over 27,000 seriously injured, some permanently. Who's going to be responsible for them? I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment, and we'll show you how our government deals with people who don't give us what we want. Please stay with us. Nice to hear from you, everyone. We're going to be going to a short piece by John Perkins in a moment. We're also going to have Robert Perry standing by to talk about the mess the U.S. made in Ukraine, relations with Russia, and the Cold War that we're in now. So while all that's in motion, let me just, you know what, I'm going to hold my Greek comments because I don't want to run short with Robert Perry. I was just told he's on the line. Let's go now to Perkins' comments about how we deal with sovereign nations that choose not to do business with us.
The precedent for economic hitmen really began back in the early 50s when democratically elected Mossadegh was elected in Iran. He was considered to be the hope for democracy in the Middle East and around the world. He was Time Magazine's Man of the Year. But one of the things that he'd run on and began to implement was the idea that foreign oil companies needed to pay the Iranian people a lot more for the oil that they were taking out of Iran. The Iranian people should benefit from their own oil. Strange policy. We didn't like that, of course. But we were afraid to do what we normally were doing, which was to send in the military. Instead, we sent in one CIA agent, Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's relative. And Kermit went in with a few million dollars and was very, very effective and efficient. And in a short amount of time, he managed to get Mossadegh overthrown and brought in the Shah of Iran to replace him, who always was favorable to oil. And it was extremely effective.
Mobs overflow Tehran. Army officers shout that Mossadegh has surrendered and his regime as virtual dictator of Iran is ended. Pictures of the Shah are paraded through the streets as sentiment reverses. The Shah is welcomed home.
So back here in the United States, in Washington, people looked around and said, wow, that was easy and cheap. So this established a whole new way of manipulating countries, of creating empire. Only problem with Roosevelt was that he was a card-carrying CIA agent, and had he been caught, the ramifications could have been pretty serious. So very quickly at that point, the decision was made to use private consultants to channel the money through the World Bank or the IMF or one of the other such agencies, to bring in people like me who worked for private companies, so that if we got caught, there would be no governmental ramifications. When Arbenz became president of Guatemala, the country was very much under the thumbs of United Fruit Company, the big international corporations. And Arbenz ran on this ticket that said, you know, we want to get the land back to the people. And once he took power, he was implementing policies that would do exactly that, give land rights back to the people. United Fruit didn't like that very much. And so they hired a public relations firm, launched a huge campaign in the United States to convince the United States, the people, the citizens of the United States, and the press of the United States, and the Congress of the United States, that Arbenz was a Soviet puppet, and that if we allowed him to stay in power, the Soviets would have a foothold in this hemisphere. And that, at that point in time, was a huge fear on everybody's mind, the Red Terror, the Communist Terror. And so, to make a long story short, out of this public relations campaign came a commitment on the part of the CIA and the military to take this man out. And in fact, we did. We sent in planes, we sent in soldiers, we sent in jackals, we sent everything in to take him out, and did take him out. And as soon as he was removed from office, the new guy that took over after him basically reinstated everything to the big international corporations, including United Fruit. Ecuador, for many, many years, had been ruled by pro-U.S. dictators, often relatively brutal. Then it was decided that they were going to have a truly democratic election. Jaime Roldós ran for office, and his main goal, he said, as president, would be to make sure that Ecuador's resources were used to help the people. And he won, overwhelming, by more votes than anybody had ever won anything in Ecuador. And he began to implement these policies to make sure that the profits from oil went to help the people. Well, we didn't like that in the United States. I was sent down as one of several economic hitmen to change Roldós, to corrupt him, to bring him around, to let him know, you know, okay, you know, you can get very rich, you and your family, if you play our game, but if you continue to try to keep these policies you've promised, you're going to go. He wouldn't listen. He was assassinated. As soon as the plane crashed, the whole area was cordoned off. The only people allowed in were U.S. military from a nearby base and some of the Ecuadorian military. When an investigation was launched, two of the key witnesses died in car accidents before they had a chance to testify. A lot of very, very strange things that went on around the assassination of Jaime Roldós. I, like most people who've really looked at this case, have absolutely no doubt that it was an assassination. And of course, in my position as an economic hitman, I was always expecting something to happen to Jaime, whether it be a coup or assassination, I wasn't sure, but that he would be taken down because he was not being corrupted. He would not allow himself to be corrupted the way we wanted to corrupt him. Omar Torrijos, president of Panama, was, you know, one of my favorite people. I really, really liked him. He was very charismatic. He was a guy who really wanted to help his country. And when I tried to bribe him or corrupt him, he said, look, John, he called me Juanito. He said, look, Juanito, I don't need the money. What I really need is for my country to be treated fairly. I need for the United States to repay the debts that you owe my people for all the destruction you've done here. I need to be in a position where I can help other Latin American countries win their independence and be free of this terrible presence from the north that you people are exploiting us so badly. I need to have the Panama Canal back in the hands of the Panamanian people. That's what I want. And so leave me alone. Don't try to bribe me. It was 1981, and in May, Jaime Roldós was assassinated. And Omar was very aware of this. Torrijos got his family together, and he said...
And he also was assassinated. That's how we have dealt with more than 51 people in other countries over the last 100 years. It's no surprise to Robert Perry. He's on our line now from Washington, D.C. Robert Perry is one of our leading progressive investigative journalists, best known for his undercovering Iran-Contra story and Oliver North's involvement, which earned him the George Polk Award for National Reporting in 1994. He is also the author of several books, including America's Sold Narrative, From Washington to Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. His website is consortiumnews.com. Nice to have you with us today, Robert.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me.
As the wife of the GOP geopolitical strategist Robert Kagan, Newland is a hardened neocon. Her husband was one of the founders of the Project for the New American Century, which included many who would later serve in George Bush Jr.'s administration. And now we are certain that the U.S. and Newland were supporting neo-Nazi and fascist elements in the Ukraine and to increase aggression towards Russia. Yet, the GOP's flirtation with neo-Nazis goes back to the 1980s and earlier when George Bush Sr. ran for president in 1988. He had a group known as the Heritage Group Council, made up of community leaders of expat Eastern European nations who would bring votes to his campaign. And this group included many neo-Nazi and fascist supporters and sympathizers. They included Ukrainians, Hungarians, Bulgarians, Romanians, and others with a sordid history of associations with pro-Nazi interests and even Holocaust deniers. And some were even Hitler's allies. And others became members of the GOP's Coalition for American Nationalities, who backed Bush's campaign. Also, all were staunch anti-communists. So there's this very dark history that the American public knows nothing about it. Most people on the left know nothing about it. The corporate Democrats know nothing about it. And yet it's very, very dangerous. And can you speak about how this legacy of U.S. government involvement with fascism and neo-Nazism has played out in the Ukraine situation? And what is it about the neo-fascist factions that is so attractive to our politicians, especially John McCain? And we need to realize how that Obama has been silent knowing all this and hence condones it, and Hillary Clinton was supporting it. So please put this into a clearer perspective by telling us what we were told happened in the Ukraine versus what really happened in the Ukraine.
Well, it certainly goes back even earlier, Gary. If you go back even to the days after World War II, when the United States quickly reconfigured its geopolitical strategies from being allied with the Soviet Union to being the major enemy of the Soviet Union, or seeing the Soviet Union as the major enemy of the United States, there was an effort to collect a number of Nazis at that time to serve as in various intelligence capacities against the Soviets, the so-called Operation Paperclip. And actually, I stumbled on it a year and a half ago too. At the time of when the Ukrainian crisis was playing out in February of 2014, I happened to be at the Reagan Library, going through some of their records, and I came upon this internal fight that they had around Radio Liberty, which is one of the U.S. sponsored radio broadcasting outlets into Eastern Europe. And this was back in the 1980s, and the Reagan people had hired old Nazis to do some of these broadcasts into Ukraine. And there was an internal dispute. Some of the Jewish groups were quite upset that these Nazis were being used. And there was a fight inside the administration about whether it was appropriate to use them or not. So this idea of using these extreme right-wing nationalists who exist in places like Ukraine has been going on for some time. It's sort of the way of looking at it is, well, this is sort of pragmatic or practical. They hate the Russians or they hate the communists, so let's use them for promoting our propaganda or for being involved in intelligence and things of that sort. So this history is certainly there. What happened when the Ukraine crisis was essentially unleashed, in part by Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, a neocon who's risen inside the State Department, was to bring back some of those old disputes and divisions within Ukraine. In Western Ukraine, there's been a very strong ultra-nationalist movement that goes back to World War II. They still honor the Galician SS and Stepan Bandera, who was one of these ultra-nationalists who collaborated with the Nazis back during World War II. So you have that history, and that history remains very alive in a place like Ukraine. And there's a great deal of resentment among those sort of pure Ukrainian nationalists toward the ethnic Russians who dominate the eastern part of the country. And when there was this coup d'etat that was pulled off on February 22nd, 2014, and embraced by the United States, in effect what that did is it ripped open those old wounds. And we saw these ancient hatreds coming out. And then the new Ukrainian government used some of these neo-Nazi militias that had been formed to carry out the coup in February of 2014. They were then brought into the military, into the National Guard, and sent off as the most aggressive fighters to kill ethnic Russians who were resisting this new order in Kiev. And one of the more interesting things that I've written about recently, even now the New York Times acknowledges it, is that as part of that, they've also brought in Islamic jihadists, some of whom are considered brothers of the Islamic State. So you now have, as sort of the tip of the spear for the U.S.-backed Kiev regime in eastern Ukraine, we have Nazis, you have ultra-nationalists, and you have jihadists who are assigned to essentially be the ones killing these ethnic Russians who they hate anyway. So I think that's sort of the history and the background of this and how it's sort of evolved to the present time.
I don't want to get too much into the crisis in the Middle East, but I do want to focus for a moment on what has been the misinformation perpetrated by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the networks versus what any reasonable and responsible journalist could have found out had they gone over there to do the story that they should have done. Tell us that in summary, please.
Well, there's been a blindness to how this crisis evolved. Basically, the New York Times, Washington Post, all the major U.S. news media just took the side of the Maidan demonstrators in the late 2013, early 2014. They put white hats on them, and they put black hats on the elected government of Viktor Yanukovych. Yanukovych had been elected largely with huge majorities from the ethnic Russian areas. So they put black hats on him and white hats on these other people, and so there was a decision almost to ignore this really ugly side of what was happening, which was that there were these militias forming in western Ukraine, groups called Sotins or groups of 100. They were being trained in street fighting, in effect, as stormtroopers, and then they were being shipped into every day being shipped by bus into Kiev to make these initial protests, which had begun peacefully, more and more violent. And so but there's been an effort by the major U.S. news media to ignore all that, because I guess they want this sort of clean-cut narrative of good guy versus bad guy. And so the Kiev government, the new Kiev regime that was put in February 22nd, 2014, they're the good guys, and they're fighting the bad guys, who are the ethnic Russians and who are supported by Vladimir Putin. So I think what you've seen is kind of a very childish, simplistic way of presenting a very complex and nuanced story. I must say it's a pattern we've seen repeated again now over and over again in the major mainstream media of the United States. We certainly saw it in Iraq in 2003, and we've seen it again and again in the years since. And now we're seeing it in a confrontation that's building up between nuclear-armed United States and nuclear-armed Russia. So the stakes have gotten immeasurably higher, but the pattern of this very simplistic reporting continues.
Finally, take your time on this. I'd like for you to give us your perspective on what you see happening in Greece since our reporting and that of Michael Hudson, who actually counseled with the Greeks, shows that the Greek foreign minister and the Greek financial minister shows that they did not have a $388 billion debt. The vast majority of that money never entered Greece at all. Yes, there was corruption. Yes, there was tax avoidance. Yes, there was bloated bureaucracies. But the Greek people are now expected to pay back this huge debt. Many of us feel that the Greek prime minister betrayed his country by not looking at any other way of getting out of here. And it looks like there's just one giant feeding frenzy that's going to go on with nationalization of Greek assets, throwing them further into the dark ages, and they can't get out. Though there are ways of forgiving that debt. Look, any central bank can print its own money. The European Central Bank can. The Federal Reserve can. They could, if they chose, pay off every penny that's owed, just like the Federal Reserve did with all the trillions of dollars it bailed out, Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. Why can't they do the same thing with those creditors and let Greece stand on its own without debt? Your thoughts, please.
Well, sure. I mean, they could print the money and then pay it off. I mean, it's sort of kind of what the Federal Reserve did in the United States. It just increased the money supply. But but basically what you've seen, and it's happened really across around the world now, is this idea of what some people call the neoliberal concept of economics, which it was applied here. We knew it as Reaganism, essentially, where you have tax cuts, which primarily benefit the rich people. You have a starving or a gutting of social programs, a failure to invest in infrastructure and development, essentially taking the so-called public sector and cutting it back or basically killing large parts of it, and relying on the private sector to do everything. And what the private sector does pretty well is it makes money for the people who are the rich people. So you have this sort of increased concentration of wealth. You have no real pushback from government. And that's now becoming part of what we see everywhere. When, in the case of Ukraine, going back to that briefly, one of the pressures, after the U.S.-backed coup was for the International Monetary Fund to come in and require the new Ukrainian government to slash all its social programs, to get rid of pensions or reduce pensions sharply, to eliminate heating subsidies for the poor, you know, and just basically do the same sort of thing. There's sort of it's almost done by the numbers now. You sort of fill in the colors, and so it's happened with Greece, and this idea of using debt as a way to pressure the political systems of these countries, essentially to blackmail them into selling off public assets and slashing programs for the people, has become a way of achieving or consolidating this neoliberal control over the world. And I think the biggest, beyond the cruelty of it all, it really doesn't work, as we've seen in the United States and in Europe, where austerity turned out not to be the way to get these economies back on track. And in the United States, there was more effort to use more thoughtful approaches to try to refloat the economy after it was run into the ditch by the Wall Street banks. But in Europe, they pretty much stuck to this austerity idea, and now they're crushing the people of Greece with 25% and more unemployment. We're seeing the same in Portugal, Greece, Spain, similar problems occurring in Italy and elsewhere. So what you're seeing is kind of a worldwide effort to roll back gains that average human beings have achieved over the decades and make it more world run by the famous 1%.
I appreciate your insights. Thank you very much, Robert, for coming on. We're out of time. Robert Perry, my guest, and he is the author of America's Stolen Narrative. His website is consortiumnews.com. I'm Gary Nall, trying to share insights that sometimes are troubling, disturbing, but necessary if we want to be empowered to make more reasonable choices. Have a nice day, everyone.
You better stop, yeah! If you don't stop, yeah.